Tonight on Arena, multi-award winning singer Ona Canavan performs live in our Galway studio, and Back to Black, Civil War, The Teacher's Lounge and The Days of Trees are the movies up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on the live stream, rte.ie/arena. And we will be coming to our four movie reviews presently. But let me start off this evening with a fantastic competition that I have for you. Thursday, May the 16th, the RTE Concert Orchestra showcasing a remarkable period in music at the National Concert Hall. This is a concert called The 50s, the decade that changed the world. Associate artist, that's associate artist with the RTE Concert Orchestra, Guy Barker will be there, as will pianist James Pearson, Giacomo Smith on clarinet and sax, vocalists Claire Teal and Cormac Keaveney. The 1950s jazz period and style is what they'll be delving into, with John Coltrane, Dave Brubeck, Miles Davis, Charles Mingus, Elvis, Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Prima and many more being represented. We will have, or do have, a pair of tickets to give away on the show this evening, along with an overnight stay at the historic Wilder Townhouse. To be in with a chance of winning that prize, text your name and answer to the following question to 51551. We'll announce the winner before the end of tonight's programme, and you have the whole programme to go and do your research. But please stay listening while you're doing that research. What is the name of the 1953 musical film that features the Academy Award winning song Sweet Love, sung by Doris Day? Sweet Love, sung by Doris Day. What's the name of the 1953 musical film that features that song? 51551 is the text for our competition this evening. So let us go then to our movie reviews. Four for you this evening, in fact. Tales of Talent, Turmoil and Trauma. Back to Black from filmmaker Sam Taylor Johnson. Story of Amy Winehouse is brought to the big screen from her early days in Camden to her global chart success. The film shows the tremendous toll of massive fame. We spoke to Alex Garland about his new high-octane thriller Civil War on the programme on Monday. That film stars Kirsten Dunst, Wagner Mara, as journalists reporting on the complete and violent demise of American society. Oscar-nominated The Teacher's Lounge is set in a German school and is a cautionary tale about unintended consequences. And master filmmaker Alan Gilson completes his loose trilogy of documentaries with a film called The Days of Trees, a fascinating story of personal revelation. But Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington have been to the pictures for us. They're with me now in studio. Let's start with Back to Black. Goes on general release tomorrow. Industry star Marissa Abela plays Amy Winehouse, who, of course, died at the age of 27 in 2011. Ruth, yeah, she really was, like many stars, and particularly stars who died young, the paparazzi were, the version of Amy Winehouse that we got was quite often through the eyes of the paparazzi, quite often through the eyes of the gossip columns and the red tops. Behind all of that was this amazing musical artist. Now, this film purports to be telling us the story of her great talent. Does it do that?
Well, yes, that is the question, Sean. I should say, first of all, I'm not the biggest fan of musical biopics, and we've had a lot of them recently. And for me, this one kind of, it falls in the middle. Can any film get to the heart of what a person was? And I think... No,
yeah, you know, yeah.
And if that's what you're looking for, you're probably always going to be disappointed. And fundamentally, the closest we can get to Amy Winehouse is listening to her music. But on the other hand, there is this, you know, really terrible and heartbreaking story behind her life. And we've heard it once already in the documentary. Amy, which I found really compelling. And I found it hard to forget that documentary when I was watching the film and almost kind of holding up one against the other and saying, oh, so you said that and you said that. It makes a good stab at it, I think. Sam Taylor Johnson's the director, and she's got empathy with her character. And you were talking about the paparazzi, and one of the ways we see her empathy with her character is that quite often we're her looking out at the paparazzi. So the cameras, you know...
We get a sense of what that must have felt like.
And just the kind of constant encirclement by these news-hungry people who are really physically coming in on top of her.
One of the first things, if you're going to do a musical biopic like this, is you have to make decisions about the performance of the music, Paul. Yeah. Is it going to be mimed to a version of Amy Winehouse's voice? Is it going to be performed by the performer in question? And in this case, it's the latter that is the choice.
It's always a better idea.
Choice that is made. Does that work, and how did that aspect of the film work for you?
Well, I think the first thing to say about this picture is that it would be good if people went to it with an open mind, because there's been this awful, which is a tendency, this trial by jury thing based upon a trailer. So people who haven't seen the film confidently talking about how bad it is. So there's that to begin with. And she doesn't look like, she doesn't sound like her. You can only judge that by watching a film, by watching a performance through a film. And I think she's really good in it. And I think that decision was the right one, because if you see the difference between Bohemian Rhapsody, which is a very enjoyable but silly film, and the Elton John film, which got much deeper, it's because the person was performing. There's no comparison whatsoever. And in this, I think nobody's going to sound like her singing, because she was who she was. But I think she does a really good job overall.
Well, let's have a listen to, this is a kind of I'm presuming a montage sequence within the film itself, where we get the song Stronger kind of being performed in a DIY kind of club to start out with. Then there's, oh no, it's just this young woman is good, and there's a little bit added, and then we get
evolving through the scene, I think.
We're hearing her career grow
and
the kind of bands that she's getting to play behind her grow.
Thought you had so many lessons to learn. I say you don't know what love is. Get a grip. Signed as if you're reading from some other tired script. Cause I'm not gonna meet your mother anytime. I just wanna grip your body over mine.
Shit, girl. No way you're only 18.
So there you go, a little bit of the song Stronger as we hear it in Back to Black, the biopic of Amy Winehouse. There is also this question, does she have to look like her, and does she have to sound like her? What's more important for me in a biopic is, do we get a sense of who Amy Winehouse is? In other words, does the actor here give us a performance of a believable character?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I think one of the things that the film does well is it dresses her really well. And she had a very definable look. Mm. She did have bulimia. The actor looks very thin and fragile in the film. They get the amazing kind of makeup. And most of all, the incredible beehive hairdo, which, you know, sometimes is up, but often becomes a kind of curtain, so that she's shielding herself from the world outside by letting her hair fall over her face. And then sometimes she's just so bedraggled that everything's kind of falling apart and the hair is everywhere. And they get, you know, she has clearly studied Amy Winehouse. There's a certain other sort of hand movement that Winehouse did when she was singing. She waves her hands kind of in the air.
And the head movement as well.
I think she studied it well. And I actually thought visually, I thought they did a really good job. And also getting the kind of sense of the interiors of the houses of that time, and the kind of, you know, she lives in pretty poor, she's got fairly, disadvantaged, but she doesn't come from money.
Yeah.
And you get that sense of kind of being enclosed by family and by just the kind of walls almost coming in on top of her.
Yeah, and of course, the ultimate part of the story here, that is the big section of the falling apart eventually of the life, is in and around the boyfriend, Blake.
Yeah, and
Jack O'Connell plays the character.
Jack O'Connell does a really good job of playing him, because I've known people like this fella, and he's just probably the best scene in the film. She's knocking back the shops, and I don't think it's the Dublin Castle. It's other pub in Camden Town. Your man comes in, saying he's won money in the horses, and he's so charismatic, and he's moving around, and he's putting on the tunes, and you'd feel like shouting at the screen, "Run away, run away!"
Run away
but
now,
but he's not a black and white villain. It's made clear. It's not the only reason why
Yeah, things went bad.
Yeah,
and the mother and father are there, but there seems to be a kind of an emphasis on the relationship with the granny here. Let's have a listen to a scene that features the granny, played by Leslie, the wonderful Leslie Manville, it has to be said. I don't know if she can be bad in anything.
Spirit of the Beehive, she's in this, because that's where it comes from. Yeah, yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So let's have a listen to Marissa Abella's Amy chatting with her granny about the new man in her life.
Blue eyes. There's a moment when we just looked at each other, you know, no words needed. We just melted into each other. No embarrassment. It just felt so warm.
Yeah. What'd you say his name was?
Blake.
Blake. Jewish?
Didn't ask, but no.
Well, how'd you know?
He had loads of tattoos.
Well, so have you. What happened to that lovely manager you brought back for dinner? Huh? Nice Jewish boy.
Nick?
Yeah.
No, he's not really my type, Nan.
You've got an eye for the bad boys, Amy Winehouse.
He didn't seem bad. He played me the Shangri-Las.
Oh.
What a sound. Nearly had me crying in the pub.
Yeah. I remember them. Queens, New York.
That melodrama, I just loved it.
Yeah. They were pretty girls and all. Just like you.
Oh, thanks, Nan.
There we go. That's Leslie Manville as Nan. The Nan of Amy Winehouse, Marissa Abella playing the character of Amy Winehouse in the new film Back to Black. I guess ultimately, Paul, at the end of this, did you come away feeling that do you need to watch the Ace of Capadia documentary as well? Or
no.
Would you just say to people, go to this and you said at the beginning, go with an open mind. Does it work?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the reason people are obsessed with how she looks and sounds is because the death is relatively recent and everybody can remember the person. But, and you could say, oh, is there a need for a biopic? It's not really a question. It's a question of, are you going to enjoy it? Are you going to be moved by it? And I think certainly you are. There's a little bit of some people are not very happy with the fact that Mitch, the dad, who doesn't come out very well in the documentary, is portrayed by Eddie Marston, who is altogether too lovable, London Jewish taxi driver. But I think it stands up very well as a film. I think that it's trying to avoid the benefit of hindsight, which I think it does very well. And I think she's really good. And that relationship with Leslie Manville is very, very touching.
Yeah. Stars from you, Paul?
4 for me, Sean.
Overall, does it work for you, Ruth, then, and stars?
A little less than Paul. I mean, what I felt was that the film is Back to Black. She stands up, she performs Back to Black. She tells us what black is in her life, where she's gone to in that black part of her life. And for me, the film didn't quite get to the real black part. And in part because it did avoid, you know, the stage shows where she's falling down drunk. And it doesn't really go...
Or depicting her death, for instance, which obviously shouldn't.
No, I didn't mind that.
Yeah,
I think that
I liked
was
that
yeah, I thought that yeah. was I thought yeah. that was sensitive, and I thought that was okay. But it doesn't really bring us into the absolute depths of her illness with bulimia, the drugs.
Yeah.
And so I don't think we quite get... And that's not her fault at all. That's not the actor's fault. We don't think we quite go there. So I'm three.
You're giving us 3. 4 and 3, respectively, there for Back to Black. Let's move on to Civil War. You've seen this one, Ruth.
Yep.
We had Alex Garland on the programme with us on Monday talking about this new film, Civil War. A near future America ripped apart by vicious conflict and presided over by a 3-term president. The film is told through the lens, figuratively and literally, of a group of photographers and reporters covering the story, led by Kirsten Dunst as a world-weary Lee.
Sadly, doesn't sound too far-fetched, does it?
It is not far-fetched at all. The first thing that I come out of the...
We were sitting beside each other watching it.
It really was a case of you had to come out and say, I need to sit down after.
Yeah.
This is a very plausibly familiar America. It feels as if this could happen tomorrow.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, one of the worst things about it is it's actually extrapolating to some extent Trump's vision of America. Because remember when he predicted the apocalypse and you know, that America is going in this direction. So it is absolutely apocalyptic.
Yeah.
Now, it's made by Alex Garland, who's got a dystopian worldview, you know, from the beach, you know, right through 28 Days Later, Never Let Me Go, Ex Machina. This is his thing, but he's gone a step further because, you know, this is maybe third term, though he's been careful enough not to make the president look like Trump in any way.
And you know, yes, some of the politics of the president in the film might match those that we would associate with Donald Trump, but it's not clearly just, oh, if Trump gets back into power, this is what's going to happen. Yeah, and it's much cleverer than
it's
that.
It's much smarter than that because, in a way, he doesn't really bother about the politics. He lets you draw your own conclusions, and we're all familiar enough with the American story at this stage. What he's saying, you know, he's extrapolating from now, and the best science fiction says takes now and makes now believable in the future. And as you say, it does. But where he really gets you, it's so visceral. And the whole society has fallen apart. It's divided into these. So it's civil war. So there's the Western Alliance,
which is between Texas and California, seems that's the only bit that seemed a little bit unlikely. But that in itself was a point.
Yeah, no, that's right. And so you've got the president. He's holed up in the White House. He's still rambling to TV because he thinks that he's in control. He's not, because around him it's just getting blacker and blacker and more violent. And, you know, it takes quite a familiar genre. These intrepid journalists, as you say, Kirsten Dunst, who I thought was fantastic, because they've let her age a little bit.
She's
world weary. She's called Leah, and so she's, you know, she's Leigh Miller. And then, you know, you've got her regular photojournalist companion, who's Joel
Vagnamara.
You've got this elderly black journalist played by Stephen McKinley Henderson, his very familiar screen presence. And then you've got the rookie journalist, Jessie, who's played by Kaylee Spaney from Priscilla. And she wants to join the grown-ups.
She wants to be. She wants to grow up and be Lee.
Lee is her role model.
So they're heading to Washington.
They're heading to D.C. because they reckon the president will resign. And they want to catch him at the moment that he resigns.
All right, so here is the point where Kaylee Spaney, his character, has managed to wangle herself into the car to travel to Washington with them. Kirsten Dunst's character is not too happy about that. A little bit of language in the midst of this clip.
I'm sorry for jamming my way into your ride, okay? I know you're really angry about it, and I know you think I don't know shit, but...
I'm not angry about that, Jesse. I don't care what you do or don't know.
Okay, but you are angry with me.
There is no version of this that isn't a mistake. I know, because I'm it. Joe and Sammy are it.
It's my choice.
Right. And I'll remember that when you lose your shit, or you get blown up, or shot.
That's Kirsten Dunst and Kaylee Spaney in the scene there.
It'll happen as well, because Jesse is suddenly confronted with the reality of the war when there are bodies hanging from... a contraption, and she goes up and looks and she realizes they're alive. They're not actually dead bodies, and she's frozen to the spot, and Lee has to rescue
her. And one of the things about, you know, there are very visceral and explicit scenes of violence, of shootings, of battle sequences, but what's most striking about what Alex Garland, for me, what he did with those sequences is he turns the photographers. They are right beside the action, like the soldiers themselves. As the soldiers run across a hallway and fire, three gunshots down the hallway, the photographer is behind them, taking a picture of that happening. You know, really putting life and limb at risk.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, you've got, like, Joel gets off on it. He's just so excited.
This is the Vagnamara character.
Yeah. So he's so excited when they see in the near distance, they see gunfire and explosions. Yeah. So he can't stop himself. He's got to be there. But then Lee has this crisis because suddenly it's just been too much. Her whole life has been this, and she just loses. It's fantastic. I mean, it really captures, you know, these little moments in their lives. So they're not all, it's not a straightforward trajectory.
And the performances.
Oh, fantastic. I just thought...
The four centre performances.
Oh, and Jesse Plemons.
Little cameo.
Oh, Jesse Plemons. chilling cameo. Yeah. I mean, when he's threatening people, he actually means it.
Yeah, yeah. Worth going to see, but
very much in the cinema. Yeah, too, because yeah, it's very visceral.
And take a big breath before you go in, and sit down for a while when you come back out. Many stars for you from this.
I give it 4 out of 5.
Four out of five. Fantastic. Yeah. Okay, so we have two more films to talk about. The Teacher's Lounge. This is set in the German school, and new documentary from Alan Gilsonen, where Tomás Hardiman tells harrowing tales of his own childhood. That coming up after this break. All right, we continue with our film reviews. Two more to speak about, and we're talking now about The Teacher's Lounge, directed by Ilker Chatak, tells the story of Carla, a well-intentioned teacher who takes matters into her own hands when one of her students is suspected of theft. This is a cautionary tale, is putting it lightly here, Ruth.
Oh, yes. If I was a school teacher, I'd watch this a couple of times and think hard about what I was doing.
Yeah.
I find this film, I just thought it was great for starters. I thought it was, you know, I was sort of thinking about its influences and, you know, they couldn't be better. Michael Haneke, and in fact, the...
Definitely.
It's
set in a German school. Did I say it was a German school?
A German school, and the central character, Carla Novak, is played by Leonie Benisch, who was in Michael Haneke's. She had an early role in The White Ribbon.
That's right.
Yeah, so there's a nice connection
nice
there.
Link but, there.
But,
and she's from Poland, isn't it?
She's from Poland, an outsider in this school, which, I mean, I kind of thought, oh, it's a progressive German school, but it may just be a German school.
Yeah. It's pointed out to her by the students that she's Polish at one point as a kind of pejorative.
Yeah, and there is this thing about being an outsider because, you know, as you said, there's a theft occurs. Yeah. And the first child who's accused of it, Ali, has Turkish parents. He's hauled in with his Turkish parents who very quickly say, well, you're accusing him because he's an immigrant. And they talk Turkish to each other and the German teachers speak in German. And the child, you know, everybody gets it. He's innocent. So our intrepid new teacher, Carla, decides she's going to find out who has been committing these thefts, and she sets a trap. So she sets up her laptop, and she puts some money rather ostentatiously in the inside jacket, pocket of her jacket, and she sets up the laptop to catch the thief. But she only gets part of the thief's clothing, which she instantly matches to a very beloved member of the school staff and accuses her, all hell breaks loose. Apart from anything else, you can't be doing that kind of thing. And secondly, she hasn't got the full image, but that dress that she has is very distinctive.
It's extremely incriminating. The interesting thing, this is full of interesting things. It's obviously a metaphor for wider society in wherever you want, not just Germany. But the interesting thing about the accused woman, whose son, unfortunately, is in Carla's class and is going to bear the brunt of all this, the woman, instead of, it's obvious that she did it by virtue of the shirt she's wearing, but instead of considering accepting in a very 2024 way, she decides that she's the victim and becomes outraged because she was videoed. She doesn't mention the money, and this is the kind of madness
but
that takes over.
This is entrapment, and this is situations where
but Sean, the point is she took the money, so it's like this is the kind of madness that goes. We know she did. And into all this, then you have parents are being obnoxious on WhatsApp groups and being ready to pounce on a new teacher because
of their
parents'
WhatsApp group being obnoxious.
Oh yeah, imagine that, Sean. Imagine that. And you have the other teachers. You have, as Ruth suggested, you've sort of incipient racism bubbling under the surface. You have a bunch of kids, Lord of the Flies stuff. The kids seem to be, they're sort of 13, I think, and they're just, they won't need much pushing to become feral, basically. So there's this really interesting mixture of things, and the road to hell is paved with good intentions is the motto of this film, the theme of this film.
And you mentioned Haneke as one of the influences here, Ruth, and you mean, yes, what I wondered about that was, are we in a world of social realism that has, you know, that has a kind of a crazy aspect to it, or do we get that kind of darker, I don't know how you define Michael Haneke's films in one easy word, but you know, that darker side that goes beyond realism.
Yeah, I'd go psychological realism because it is about the inner psychology of these characters projected onto an already dysfunctional world. And the school is, you know, it's not a leap to say, it's a microcosm of a dysfunctional society. And the children are learning from the adults, and they're learning their bad behaviour. In particular, there's a sequence where they call her in to interview her for the school paper, and the kids are kind of placed around the room, and they're waiting for her to open her mouth. Mm. And as soon as she does, they trap her.
Yeah.
And then they, and in the end, they, you know, they spin the story. They write it up in the school paper. It's out there. She can do nothing about it, even though they've taken her words.
It does. Sorry, Ruth. It does have that sort of existential gloom that you get in Hanukkah. But that sequence is very interesting, as Ruth suggests, because the kids who are really, they are the most obnoxious. Would-be journalists. They say at one point, "Well, you know, we can't reveal our sources." They're talking about gossip, but they can. You know, in this age, they can be forgiven for confusing gossip with fact, because that's what happens now all the time.
Well, you are always animated and always informative when you come into studio. I've seldom seen the both of you so equally excited about a movie.
It's very good.
Loved it.
Yeah, really good. I mean, there were a couple of bum notes. I'm just seeing, you know, just, but I thought the ending was too abrupt. I'd have loved them to just play that ending out a little longer so you could think about what's happening at the ending, but it's very good.
Starts from you on this one, Paul?
Yeah, I think five. I think there's bound to be the odd thing when you're trying to do so much at once and trying to bring so many characters together and discuss so many things at once. So I really liked it.
Five from you. And Ruth, from you?
I give it four, but, you know, I'd have been nudged to five if Paul had, you know, elbowed me.
Okay, so a four with just a nudge needed to bring it up. So clearly very high recommendation.
So the half stars are from both of you.
Okay, let us move on to our final film. Paul, you've seen this one.
Yeah.
New feature documentary from filmmaker Alan Gilson, and if to nominate it, The Days of Trees. This is a very unusual piece, very thoughtful piece about, and I want to be very careful about what I say. I'm saying uncovering trauma. It's a really, because it's a term that becomes really important in how the story is told. Tell us the story that is being told and the subject who's telling us about the subject who's telling us the story.
Well, Alan makes, he never approaches something head on or directly. He makes these very oblique films in a very good way, like the Bagatonia film, I think it was last year or the year before, was very interesting. He's always talking about patinas in Ireland of the past. And in this film, Tomás Hardiman, who was a producer on a lovely documentary that Alan made about Ivor Brown, who sadly died earlier in the year. And during that documentary, which Tomás produced, he began seeing Ivor Brown in sessions. And during those sessions, he doesn't like the word suppressed or but this memory, which was the only thing that could explain and tally with how his life had gone, came out about sexual abuse by a Christian brother in Tuam when he was very young. To say that this film is just about that is extremely reductive. Mm. What they did is the two of them and Bob Brennan, the sound recorders, they went to Glenstall during COVID for a week. And nature supplied a storm halfway through it, and there's these trees moving, and it's very gothic in a way.
And it's shot in black and white for the most part. We get some archive in colour.
Yeah.
It is in black and white.
It's in black and white.
And it's just Tomás Hardiman talking directly to camera.
It is, and it's Alan, because he would have felt that he represented the audience. He had to ask hard questions, and he does ask him hard questions, and it's very emotional. And he's saying, or people will say, oh, you know, I've forgotten or remembered. But through the film, it all becomes apparent. They're very lucky as well that they had home movies from the Hardiman family, which are really, in the end, because the actual discussion of the main event, as it were, comes late in the film, but they give it so much subtext, and you realise this is a child here that we're talking about.
Let's have a listen to, this is quite early on, and I loved the fact that Tomás Hardiman, obviously with his producer's hat on, was already questioning whether it was a good idea to ask him, the individual, about, you know, his story.
I think it's very risky for an individual to tell the truth. It's risky. Like, I think my brain works differently when I'm speaking about this, because it's traumatic in itself. It actually, my perception of what's going on starts to get a little bit shimmery, you know? There have been times when I think maybe I am wrong. this is the real serious thing when you look at it. Like, the amount of my time that has just gone up the chimney in smoke, something that could have been, I could have been giving it to my family, I could have been giving it to workmates, I could have been, you know, have a consistent, worthwhile life. That's what's snatched. It's like just taking the air out of a balloon.
Yeah, and that's the point he makes, is like, who might I have been if this hadn't happened to me? And yet not bitter.
Not at all. And that's Tomás Hardiman, by the way, from The Days of Trees. You know, and it's not as if he didn't have a very successful and fulfilled life. You know, we get a sense of his current situation, that he's very at home with who he is himself.
Yes.
And the way he talks about his family, I think, is it quite large? Was it 8 or 11?
Seven
siblings.
Yeah. He said it was a reasonably large family. That's the Ireland of the time, yeah.
And his father did die when Tomás was in his 20s. But his mother, when this film was made, was still alive.
She was at
104.
Yeah, and we see her, singing.
And we see that lovely footage. But he talks about the relationships with his family and how lucky they were to all be together, unscathed, no illnesses, no sudden deaths, no nothing.
No.
And then he starts to call out their names. And it's when he's talking about the nicest of things that he gets most upset.
Yeah, and you can see that's where he is, because that's what he's had to dredge up with Ivor Brown. Or quite early on in the film, I talked to Alan Gilson, and he said to me that early on in the first half an hour, he was talking, his brother, Tomás's brother, had died, and he got very upset.
Yeah.
And then he thought, geez, we're not going to get through this.
Yeah.
But in fact, one of the remarkable things about this film is that it is a portrait of a person's life, not just that part of his life.
Yeah.
And in a way, you can think, well, how much he achieved in spite of it.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. It's a lovely line about his brother. I think he read a poem. He doesn't read the poem first, but he gives us the title of the poem, which I think is so amazing. Mm. I never didn't love you.
Talk about it. Irish.
You're not going to say I love you, I never didn't love you covers everything. In fact, it's a wonderful statement.
Yes, it is. It is. It is. And you get a sense of his time at the Abbey. He was press officer at the Abbey, and there's a wonderful clips of him with Tom Murphy singing.
He sings a song with Tom Murphy.
Yeah. He had a high old time of it. And as Alan says, he was a wild man in the best sense in his youth, but something was dogging him, and he had never quite confronted it until he'd started doing this.
I think it's important to say too, like, what happens to him later on is, without being in any way anything other than very straightly told, he's very specific in what exactly happened to him.
He tells
us absolutely straight, and it's done in a way that you just listen.
Yeah, absolutely, and it is that you're right, Sean. There is something kind of shocking in how calm he is about it, because he said he's more emotional about other things than about this. But this is just what it is. He's very clear also that he has no intention of naming the person, and he feels, though this is different for other people, that were he to go to the law, you become a victim all over again, and that was not for him, because that would be attaching him to it for the rest of his life, whereas he wants to move on.
Yeah, he said this. He has control over this part of it in a way that he didn't have when he was younger. I must say, it knocked me for six this afternoon.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Incredibly moving.
I watched it late. I'd like to have seen it on the screen. I watched it late one night at home, and it happened to be stormy as well. And I mean, it's remarkable. It's a remarkable documentary.
Yeah, if stars seems facile, but
it does a bit. But I get to use a half star, 4.5 stars.
4.5.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. My thanks to Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington. I just need to bring up something up on my screen here. My thanks to Ruth Barton and Paul Whitting, The Days of Trees, which we've just been talking about, will be at the IFI from tomorrow with them the Pallas in Galway and the Triskel in Cork in the coming weeks. You can see local press and thedaysoftrees.com for more information on that. Back to Black and Civil War go on general release tomorrow, and The Teacher's Lounge will be in selected cinemas from tomorrow. Dubliner Eoghan Canavan is a singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist whose melodies are deeply rooted in the Seán Nós tradition. His voice carries echoes of the greats such as Sorokini Grúm, Seán McConaughey, and Canavan brings a contemporary twist, I think, to the timeless Irish stories that he's telling. He's played with bands like Skipper's Alley and Jiggy, and his collaboration with Clare Fiddler Ulton O'Brien was a classic. His debut solo album, The Deepest Breath, captivated audiences far and wide, and I'm delighted to welcome Ollie Canavan from our Galway studio this evening. That kind of, that mix that is going on at the moment, Owen, and you're very much part of that movement, Skipper's Alley, Lancome, John Francis, you know, all of these people who are taking these traditional songs and somehow giving them a very contemporary, very modern twist. And of course, you've got original material of your own in there as well. Are you kind of aware of what you're doing? Or are you just doing what feels right?
How's it going, Sean? Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Not at all.
I don't know. I think we're all influencing each other, really, and listening to all of the people you mentioned. I know that, like, you know, we would have a huge respect for the kind of, you know, the, I mean, you mentioned a few people there, like Sorokin Yehoram and Sean O'Connor, and you can add in, you know, the likes of Liam Weldon and Lou Kelly. I'd be, you know, a big fan of those as well. And I think, I don't think, well, for me anyway, I'm not kind of consciously trying to, you know, you're just influenced by the music around you, I suppose, and then you're trying to put your own, develop your own kind of craft as well, and see where that goes. Like, it's,
you're not following some formula. It is, I suppose, and that's what traditional music is about, isn't it? It's taking the music of the people, making it your own, and performing it your way. By the way, I should have said congratulations on the best singer and best album, was it? Certainly best singer at the RTE Folk Awards in February, singer of the year at the Grattan Cole TG Cahir Awards. That kind of recognition, how important is that to you, Owen?
Yes, really, really nice to be recognised, I suppose, for the singing. You know, I've been singing kind of since I was very small, and it's great to see that. I suppose that some people like it anyway. But I think as well, it's just the music, and I suppose it's like as you kind of said there. There's a kind of a community of us. In Ireland, but obviously in Dublin as well.
I was going to say there's a community of you in Stony Batter. If you open your front door and shout a couple of names, you'll have a session in 10 minutes. you're all in and around the same area.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, it's like, you know, that's kind of what we're, you know, having that. And then, you know, obviously there's lots of music all over the country. And that's kind of where we draw on that, on all of that, I suppose, yeah.
Let's listen to something. You have the concertina with you, I think. Will you, is this The Deepest Breath has the concertina in it, I remember.
It does.
And this is from the album from a couple of years back.
Yeah, well, I might start off with, I was thinking of start off without the concertina and do with, it's because it just started off nice and easy with, it's a song called Merica. Yeah, so over on the big, for me, I had for session on the water. I heard it from my father first, but he got it from his mother, and I actually heard her sing it once when she was 94 years of age, and she had a very high and frail voice. So it's beautiful to be able to hear her sing it. But an emigration song, America, obviously America. Yeah. So I'll give it a go.
All right, glad.
The creek is glanty head and the galler goes from its bang o' jaw. My dowry to her o' hell, my head a goes more villain's door. Nach en troig an mes ma stoid in gos loch din tog i an America. Son long is far eng shorse, fwy rach sio nen y tarintan. Tan ari gisio toki, ni sy'n tolti eich lwng na'ch band. Moro ba mwyd malert corach, glac mo chorlygus fan golach. Shemolem gan me mwenin, no mwen y can o hwm gotwm. Mary siądź kielgo de velin, a nie antaram serum. Da grubo tergyn an chair, sto steche menis lagon zu. Nach kleure bachte schelles magelte lige verglum. Sei vrit frina fola gudjoga se allem ri. Skum arlam gal poste, her mustar gam an mechun kreen.
Mericá an tar an sin Conaithe ag Óna Canavan. Óna Canavan there with a song called Mericá. You got it from your father, you were saying, agus bí an ghaeilge an teanga bhí agus sa teach. How important that the fact that you did have Irish growing up on, when you're singing in Irish, and particularly a song like that, that has, you know, has the sense of the ancient almost in it, what does the language give to you in that situation?
Well, I suppose it's kind of one and the same with the song, you know. I mean, it's Irish is my first language. My mother's from Dublin, but she learned Irish actually before any of our myself or my older sister, any of us were born, basically. And she only spoke Irish to us. And my father's obviously from Connemara, so we just had Irish at home, and then like the songs were like part of that, and as well just learning songs from both of them, really, mostly from my dad. But I think it's kind of
you had one without the other. Did your mother have to learn the Irish to capture the heart of the Connemara man? Was that the reality?
Well, the way she tells it, she was already learning Irish when she met him, and he wanted to speak English to her to get to know her, and she wanted to speak Irish to him to practice. she's teaching in a girls' school now as well, so she's completely fluent now.
And of course, music. Music was all over. Your two sisters are involved in the music industry as well.
My older sister Silog has two solo albums out, and piano player, singer, fiddle player, and then Muireann plays a cello and concertina and sings as well, and played with a band called Mongoose and is doing her own stuff now as well. So you couldn't really get away from the music at all.
It's Muireann. There's a lovely video of The Deepest Breath. I think it was Miles O'Reilly that made the video. I think it was. Is Muireann that's playing the cello?
It's actually not. No, it's that's the videos with Ian Kinsella on the guitar, and then Caitlin Cullen Verhaeghe on the cello. So I play kind of with the two of them a lot, kind of as a trio, like.
And that's, I loved the Anál na hÉithe. Is Anál na hÉithe the title of the album, or is it the title of the first track? I think it's the title
the
of the first
track.
I loved that Anál na hÉithe. What is the breath of the night, as opposed to the deepest breath that you have in the song later on and in the album title?
Yeah, it's kind of funny that there's that sort of breath has kind of gone through the album. It's kind of a I don't know how to translate online the he, but it kind of it's sort of night breathing or the breath of the night. But it's basically, there's two songs, the first track and the last track on the album. They're kind of sister songs. I think of them as Bonheilch is the last track. It was kind of like First Light, and it's basically they're the same melody but different, accompanied completely differently. And they're, I suppose, in the subject matter, they're related. One of them is about kind of being in the middle of the turmoil, and the other is kind of coming out of that. So,
The deepest breath. Dreams seem to be important to you. They're certainly important in this song. Where do dreams sit with you? Because you have an interesting take on them, I think, in this song.
So the deepest breath, I suppose it's it kind of came to me after, I was kind of thinking about freedom and creativity in this kind of society in general. And then I remember reading about a woman called Annie who died in homeless accommodation, left behind her two children. And I think I was kind of thinking about, like, it was just kind of, at the time I was just thinking about the way that, I don't know, when we were growing up, you kind of, I think you hear a narrative of you can do anything you want if you put your mind to it and all that kind of thing. But a lot of it is kind of in this kind of quite individualistic, sort of competitive sort of a way, the way that kind of society is set up. And it was supposed to be, I think, I wanted to kind of go against that, but at the same time not give up on dreams and hopes and all that kind of thing at the same time.
Yeah, that's what I loved. Yeah. I love the kind of the complexity of that. That it's not dreams if you have to walk over several people to get your dream fulfilled. Make sure that your dreams, that you still have a sense of those around you as much as yourself. Will you give us the song? Will you give us the deepest breath? Owen?
I will do. Yeah. Give it a go now. Yeah. So. Call the hand that once held yours, furrowed face now forever empty. She was old before she'd lived her youth, hollowed out in a land of plenty. And did you dream last night, child? Did your dream stay with you? Oh, the city sucks the wild from your mind, so hold your dream before it hits you. And wear your dreams, they're all that fit you. We dig these graves now every day. Eternal homes denied in lifetime. And the rich men wave our lives away. Can't see a soul without a price tag. And did you dream last night, child? Did your dream stay with you? Oh, this town can burn the bright of your mind, so hold your dream before it hits you. And wear your dreams, they're all that fit you. Song to sing, for your songs are a glimpse of a flickering freedom, and we're not yet spent and we've a world to win. And there'll be no king, but it'll be our kingdom. And did you dream last night, child? Did your dream stay with you? Oh, this land can leech the light from your life, so hold your dream before it hits you. And wear your dreams, they're all that fit you. And when you sing on, oh love, you've got songs aplenty. Oh, they'll try to tear the truth from your mouth, so sing on strong, make sure they felt it. Oh, sing out now, for your soul's not empty. Sing on, in your song fights the highest hope of all. Dream on, our dreams are the deepest breath we draw. Sing on, in your song fights the highest hope of all. Dream on, our dreams are the deepest breath we draw. Sing on, in your song flies the highest hope of all. Dream on, our dreams are the deepest breath we draw. Our dreams are the deepest breath we draw. Our dreams are the deepest breath we draw.
Our dreams are the deepest breath we draw. That's I'm sorry, I spoke over your last little concertina note there, Owen O'Callaghan. But that there's some amazing lyrics within that song. Where your dreams, they're all that will fit you. You really have that belief in the kind of following the dream. I suppose in some ways, are you talking about following the artistic dream in for yourself as much as anything else?
No, I think it's more. It's a good question, but I think it's trying to the song. I think it's well, it's hard to explain a song, but I think the feeling of that we have in this world is just. I think that human beings are all human beings are inherently creative and they have the capacity to make art and make beauty. And I think that the system under which we live makes it very difficult for the vast majority of people to reach their full kind of
potential
yeah. as human beings and as creative beings. And I think it's something that we have to fight for. I guess that's kind of what it's trying to do, I think, for myself, but in general, I think.
Just one thing before we finish up. You started teaching yourself the concertina at about 14, about the age of 14. And I noticed, like, it's a very different instrument when you use it the way you used it there as an accompaniment to a song. I presume that you also use the concertina as just, here's a tune on the concertina and I won't be singing at all.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I would have started. Like, yeah, I remember. I don't know. We had the concertina in the house. My sister was playing it. My dad was playing it as well. And I just started messing around with it. And then Larry Kinsella, who's passed away since, actually, dad brought me to him for a lesson just to show me the system. And then after that, I kind of made my own way. But yeah, I would have been just playing in sessions and that kind of. It's only kind of in recent years really that I've used it as an accompaniment, just for actually often for writing songs because I don't play guitar or piano and like that. And it's good for figuring out chords and that kind of thing.
Well, Gurmila Mahagatas Fetling Anocht, August Gurmahagatas and Gor Aaron Chin. Thanks so much, Owen.
Thanks a million, Sean. Cheers. Thanks for having me.
That's Owen O'Callaghan, the Gradam Kuil TG Cathair Award. Concert will be broadcast live on TG Cathair from the University Concert Hall, Limerick. That's on May the 5th at 9:30 p.m. Other recipients who will be performing on the night, along with Owen O'Callaghan, are Derek Hickey, Jean Butler, the Kane Sisters, Ryan Malloy, McDara O'Fuilleann, and members of Cardus Navidleri. Tickets from UCH.ie. Earlier, we asked you a question to win tickets for the RTE Concert Orchestra event, the 50s, the decade that changed the world, taking place at the National Concert Hall. Tasman Hogan from Waterford correctly answered. Calamity Jane was the musical we were looking for. She and a guest will be heading to the concert and staying at the historic Wilder House. Full details on that concert on rte.ie/CO. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Niall Fitzmaurice and Leah Murphy were the researchers. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath sound here in Dublin and John Doyle helping us out in Galway this evening. Gormila Mahagat John. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1.